This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
You know, in Rocky Horror, Tim Curry was very influential for a lot of people, but he always kind of, you know, was like uncomfortable with Frankenfurter and because, you know, if you were openly gay, you couldn't work, and, you know, so he was always kind of a little running from that. But they just had a big thing at the Castro Theater in San Francisco, and they had him there because he was suffering from a stroke, but, you know, his mind is all there, and people perform for him, and he finally kind of got, you know, the love that he was running from, you know, from his greatest role, you know, suddenly realizing how much effect it had, and it was so touching. So I'm about to have a stroke. I'd like you to be there for me.
So welcome, everyone. So glad to see you here. My name is Patrice Petro. I'm the director of the Carsey Wolf Center, and we're just really thrilled to have John Cameron Mitchell with us, co-writer, author, actor, director, and star of Hedwig, and so much more. First off Broadway, then in the 2001 film you just watched, later in a Tony-winning Broadway revival, and so on. Mitchell is one of the most prolific and beloved queer artists of our generation, I could say. I'm very, very thrilled to have him here, and I know you are too. So to begin, I wanted to ask you, I know that... as we, from the applause and the ages in the group, I know you have many admirers in the audience tonight, but I also know that nearly 25 years after the release of the film, new audiences are discovering Hedwig for the very first time. So what would you tell audiences who are new to the film about this now canonical work of queer cinema?
Well, I don't know, because I'd almost rather... someone asked me because, you know, it was such a time in my life and the making of it, you know, the film isn't my life, the making of it is. And sometimes I'd rather make, you know.
But even the time, that period in the late 90s, early 2000s, as opposed to, compared to where we are now.
Well, you know, it was the last golden age of American cinema was the 90s and or early 2000s until the financial collapse and the rise of digital. So it was a kind of magic time, you know, that the 30s and 40s, of course, the 70s was another golden age that we grew up in. And so Hedwig is a child of definitely at the 70s in terms of the mix of the music. We even, you know, shot on in a way that we sort of echoed some of our favorite people in the 70s, like Bob Fosse and Richard Lester and people who were trying stuff. And weirdly, they were also popular, you know, which is sort of different now. You don't always think of the very best films as being the moneymakers these days. But it was also, you know, Hedwig kind of came out of the tail end of a lot of despair and rage during the AIDS crisis. So it by the time we made it, the drugs had appeared, so that had settled down. But the core of it, of rage, was still there, of you know, someone who didn't belong. And a story of abuse, trauma that... you know, some people go, well, it's a trans story. And I'm like, I don't know if you're kind of coerced into an operation against your will by your boyfriend and your mother and your government defining a woman as a man without a penis. You know, it's a very strange... And East Germany was like that. You know, there was this weird... thing after World War II where, you know, the communist circle was sort of going to be anti-Semitic, you know, pro-woman, eventually pro-gay. But it was always a kind of just gesture, right? I mean, in Russia, certainly Jews couldn't even go to college, you know, and it was always this sort of fake thing. But the fact that Hedvig came out of that place where my father was the military commander, she actually lived in Berlin when my father was her commander.
It's true, who knew?
Could have told her to do anything. And I was going to the punk clubs while he was ruling. And that's kind of where Hedvig came from, is my meeting people from the East. You know, Nina Hagen was a singer from the East. There was an amazing film called I Am My Own Wife, about a documentary about a woman who had lived, a man, really a trans woman, it wasn't really a word for it then, who lived that way under the Nazis and the communists. Uh-huh. You know, it was quite a story. It's an amazing documentary. You should check it out. It's been made into a play as well. So I guess we were busting up a few things, but it felt comfortable. You know, it's like we were supported. New Line Cinema, who had come up with John Waters, was the financer. They were doing Lord of the Rings, but they were doing this. So right. They were giving me a lot of attention and letting me make my first film. I had never made a short. Interestingly, the guy who headed New Line, Bob Shea, I was also a director, you know, which is unusual for a studio chief to be a director. And I was in a film of his called Book of Love in the 80s, and it wasn't a great experience. In fact, it made me move to New York. But but he was very, you know, remember the old good old days? And I'm like, no, I don't. You know. But he was sweet, and he came to see Hedvig, and he's like, I'm going to help you make this, and I think you should direct it. So I'm like, I mean, when does that happen? You know, it's all committees and corporations now, but there was a couple of people, unfortunately, one of them was Weinstein. the personal touch. But Bob really did believe in directors, and, you know, he was savvy about money, too. But he let me make a film with a real budget, with myself starring and directing. It wouldn't happen today.
Yeah, crazy.
Well, I wanted you to talk a little bit about Hedvig in its earliest incarnation, which, you know, as you just said, it started in a drag club as a 30-minute version of what would later become this feature-length film. This was 1994, and you had been discussing ideas for a show with your friend, Stephen Trask, who was a composer and musician, and whose gigs included leading the house band at Squeeze Box, and allowed you to incarnate Hedvig and play there. So tell us a little bit about what was, I want to ask you about the adaptation process. I mean, how did it move from 30 minutes on stage to?
Well, that was many years, you know.
Earlier,
Yeah, I mean, 30 minutes was, you know, we only had one original song, so I would take pre-existing songs and rewrite the lyrics to be about Hedvig for that. Like Fleetwood Mac or Bowie or something. Yoko Ono had a song called Death of Samantha, which was we made into about the operation. So I was writing, you know, coming from the theater, not going to rock and roll and drag places, but I wasn't of that world. So, you know, even the queens there were a little suspicious of what I was doing. Am I, you know, kind of slumming or taking the piss or something? And I'm like, no, I'm learning from you guys. I want to know. You guys are punk, and you didn't even know it, you know. And it was right when punk actually was commercial for the first time in the early 90s. So I was always a rock and roul person and soul and funk. So in the gay world, which was more four on the floor kind of music, dance music, which could be great, but I was just kind of bored, and I wanted a more queer, you know, punk vibe. And certainly at that time it was happening. So Squeezebox was the place I always dreamed of, which was a rock and roll. It was a punk drag party bar. There was a house band. Regular bands would play, and then the house band would play with a local drag queen who was singing a punk or rock cover. And a lot of them had only been lip syncing up to that point and didn't realize that they were already punk and their voices were were great. So they many act performers found themselves there. And it was a fun place, you know, and we enjoyed the fact that, you know, straight rock stars or someone would come and be scared of us. You know, these cocky, you know, Beastie Boys or whatever, they could not handle it. We'd run them out on a rail, and John Waters would be there every weekend, and it was a hoot, and it was a little bit scary, and I was learning along the way. The very first show we did, you know, was so exciting, and I was actually, afterwards, a scout was there, and he said, "Well, you were great, we want you to perform at Woodstock."
What?
And I couldn't hear, I thought they were saying Wigstock, you know, which is it's like, sure, why not? But it was the new Woodstock when they rebooted it in 94. It never worked out, but so that was 94. You know, the film really was shot in 2000. And between those two, there was a lot of stages of Hedwig, including off-Broadway. But we were never, like, really popular. It was never a huge moneymaker. It was always sort of like Hedwig sort of clawing her way to the middle, yeah. You know. And then the film, there was a strange kind of almost a bidding war for it. And we went with Bob Shea, my director.
Why do you think that was?
It was the 90s. You know, it was yeah. Cool. You know, it was a different time. You know, now it's like, it's just very different, you know. You all, I'm sure, know what it means right now to be young. It's a strange thing to be young today. Not only with what's happening in the world, but also just the way you got here with a certain digital, you know, you were delivered by the delivery system called digital culture. And that teaches you when you're very young to quantify and your self-value, you know, like by likes and clicks. And that's very capitalist, you know. It's like you're taught to be, to market yourself and brand yourself very young, whether you want to or not, you know, it's there. And it's strange. The anonymity, you know, anonymous labor.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, I would hate it right now. If I had made Hedwig now, I might've shot that first show, which wasn't that good. And then looked at it and then not continued it. You know, there's a value in not documenting. You don't want to, I never liked when people showed pictures of their fetus. You know what I mean? Show me the baby. It's like it interrupts the development of the fetus by looking at it. It's like quantum physics. You don't know where the particle is until you look. So I'm all for letting things happen in the dark until they're ready to go to the next step, so they're not crushed, you know. And I would have crushed it if it had been today. So that, you know, whatever you're doing, don't rush it out too fast. You know, think about it. Take some time. There's a beauty in having something that you're working on for a very long time. It's like raising a child that's not necessarily going to hate you at a certain age. And that's what Hedwig has become. You know, it feels like a child or an ex-wife who is not paying her child support.
I've been struck by the way, when I've listened to various interviews that you've done, or, I don't know, podcasts, I've been struck by the way that you describe your creative process, which really resonated with me. And, you know, we work in different realms. But even when I think about my own work or books that I've written and where the ideas come from, and that originality, it's not like, you know, it comes, springs directly from your mind. But I wondered if you've said that creativity is profoundly collaborative for you. And you've said, too, that, you know, to combine one's inner life and imagination with other attachments that you have. So to create Hedwig, you've said that you and your friends combined your love of Broadway musicals with drag, with punk, with Plato, with the Gnostic Gospels into a new and something, a really new hybrid. So it's this, at the cross currents of different ideas that were prevalent in the people you knew, the things you were reading. So I wondered if you'd talk a little bit more about that. I know in the audience we have a lot of aspiring filmmakers and creative people.
Well, you know, our creativity, you know, I have I like to work in audio, and I have a couple of fictional podcast series out. One that's just coming out now called Cancellation Island. And Holly Hunter plays a wellness guru who creates a rehab for canceled people. Carefully curated. All the therapists are Gen Z, because what they lack in life experience, they make up for in certainty. But you know, everything's kind of uncertain now, isn't it? You know, and it's strange to be in this country right now and be someone that you think of as maybe evolved or thinking for themselves, because it doesn't seem to be that time in the air, and we're all a little stunned, not sure what to do, right? But I'm in New Orleans now. One of the reasons is because it is still a creative city. It's built into the culture. Today is Mardi Gras. And there's tornado warning, and they're all out there, you know, because we're used to the disaster. We should all be like New Orleanians. The hurricane is coming. And art for art's sake is still possible. And in fact, the rule there, you know, it's a city in drag in a way. And so there's a sense of that being the only antidepressant is creativity. Using your imagination for some purpose, and it doesn't have to be a book or a play. I mean, it can be my garden. It can be your child. It can be whatever, you know, fixing your car, you know, is a creative act, especially cool old cars. My brother, you know, puts together old motorcycles, and it's beautiful to see. These are the things that actually combat the things that we're afraid of right now, even if it's spiritually combating it. And I'm telling these young people, you know, who are scared, it's like, okay, let's not look macro anymore. Let's not try to fix the world in the shortest period of time, which is what we've been doing in the last few years, is trying to fix everything really fast and alienating our friends while we do it sometimes, looking for purity. And we end up breaking ourselves up into identities, which are great to separate yourselves from the people who had power over you, like your parents. But at a certain point, if identity becomes your main activity, it starts to become a prison. You know, it's a springboard to go somewhere else. It's like, we don't hang out with our friends and think about their identity. We think about who they are and what they got to bring to the party. And that's what you get in New Orleans. That's what I get growing up in the military. The military was the most eclectic, diverse group in America. It's a socialist state for rednecks and poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And you get free health care. You get housing. You get cheaper food. You have everyone from everywhere in the world. And you don't care about identity. You care about who's there and what are they doing to you and how much they love you and what are they bringing to the job and who are you dancing with. And that is theater. It can be film. It can be any collaborative, creative experience. What have you got to bring? You know, it makes me so happy. It keeps the fear at bay, at least the fear of the unknown. You know, fear of the known is something else. We have, you know, we know certain things we have to take care of. And then there's just general fear, which is not useful. And I always seek out collaborators because I don't want to do it alone. I seek out new forms. I met a guy on Grindr. We had sex. I said, what are you doing? He's like, I'm working on a narrative project. I'm like, what? Film? And he's like, no, I'm actually doing a fictional series on the OnlyFans platform. So he's telling a story through the posts of a porn actor, and the character is an OnlyFans porn actor, but the actor isn't. And you subscribe and you find out more about his life. And I was like, that's cool. And also, you know, dealing with what OnlyFans can do to a young person. So it's like really getting it. But also the sex was supposed to be real, you know. It's like my film Short Bus. I always thought, why do they keep cutting away from the sex when it's an important part of our lives and our stories? But he was going to, then he chickened out and didn't even do the sex. And then the actor wasn't that good. Though he did keep one scene that I suggested, which is in one of the posts, his mom comes out on camera and it's like, I know Derek doesn't want me to be here right now, but he's a person and I'd like you to treat him like a human being. Well, okay, I'm going to go now. You know, and then it's like, so it's like, you know, taking a form that doesn't necessarily do what it does and seeing if it can. You know, how does drag, which we think of as something more fun, get really serious? You know, which it was in the Greek and Roman times. And kabuki. But, you know, it's like, what if should be at the beginning of your creative endeavor? And it's always more fun if there's someone else helping you answer that.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
So tell us a little bit more. I mean, Hedvig clearly draws on a number of interests that you had, friends that you had, collaborations that you made. But it also draws on your own biography. Now, you've mentioned your father. Then the East Berlin framing story. But I was hoping you could tell us more. I mean, obviously, it starts like Hedvig is supposedly born in 61.
Yeah.
Right? You're 63. You were
yes.
born in 63.
Yes.
But you pick it, of course, you want this, you know, world historical date.
Yeah. Though young people play, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, East and West and the divide, which is, you know, I mean, well into the 80s, that was a major...
It's a real thing.
A real thing. So I wanted you to talk more about how your own experiences in both Berlin and when you were traveling a lot in the States, how that shaped this story of an East German, a trans girl rocker.
Well, all of the... I probably wouldn't call her trans, but, you know, it... Unless you're forced into trans... But, you know, in Iran, so weird. They, you know, it's against the Quran and the Bible to be gay, and you can be killed for it. You know, it's against Islamic law. But being trans isn't. It's also not mentioned in the Bible either. So the government of Iran will pay feminine boys to get a gender reassignment, whether they like it or not, to fit in to what I call the binarchy. You know, it's like you have, this is man, this is woman, and there's nothing else. It's like, we all know, we're all in the middle, you know, if you think about it. I'm not so much into the term non-binary just because it's a negative. You know, I don't like, that's not gonna last if it's a negative term. Also, it implies that binary is the default, which, I don't think it is. I think we're all androgynous to an extent. But the all the army military bases were run by the spouses of the soldiers and sailors, and they were all German, Korean, or Filipino. Everyone on base was run by German, Filipino, because that's where our main goals were. And some British wives. My mom was British. And so it was like the mix was already always there. There was a babysitter we had named Helga, who was the inspiration for Hedvig. She lived in a trailer. She had a lot of dates. She never knew what the dates were going to look like. We thought, she's popular. She's not even that good looking. She's amazing. And we would, you know, and she, you know. If they would come up the driveway, the guys, and we would have to go out the back, me and my friend Brenda. But sometimes if Helga didn't like the look of the guy, she'd go out the back too. And so this character was in our world. And I just was looking around at Squeeze Box at these amazing performers, and there was more was coming, you know, more ideas were coming. And the origin of love myth comes from Plato's Symposium, 400 BC. You know, that was the story. It's the exact story of that song. And that was his first song he wrote when I gave him the book. And so that was the center of it. It was always the origin of love as the center of it. And then the meat of it was put on top of that.
So that was the first song?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the one that was you were doing in 94?
Yeah.
And how did your view of what the symposium or what you're looking for your other
30 years ago? Jesus Christ.
I know. But I just after that number, Hedvig muses and says, "It's clear I must find my other half. But is it a she or a he? Does my other half have what I have? What I don't? What about sex? Is that how we put ourselves back together again? Or can two people actually become one again?" So, you know, I'm wondering if you want to say more about it. I tell you personally, my older daughter, whose first tattoo that I would did not approve of and didn't even know she did, was of the yin-yang from Hedvig. No. And she loved Hedvig. But it was always this emphasis on the search for your other half. When I would say, you're whole, you know. And of course, she knows too. I mean, the film is all about that. Hedvig has
to. Ultimately, as you can see, pronouns do not work for Hedvig. Is that they are trying to find their inherent inner wholeness, and you see it actually in the animation. Kind of happen in front of you, because when you ask someone, the myth is interesting because it's flexible. You know, it's like, oh, well, obviously another person will complete me. But it's like, well, you know, if you take the myth on its face, you weren't the same person. You were just reduced, and you're seeking to find the rest of yourself, not so much another person, but we interpret it in different ways. And for Hedvig, Tommy seems to be her other half, but probably not. You know, it's probably the sum of everyone she's known. And in the experience of those people, she has found a kind of wholeness at the end. And the drag, which was really armor, you know, to put on at the worst possible time in her life, is a tool. It's a cocoon, and then you let go of, you know, the shell, and you become naked in a street, and gender is unimportant. You are a gender of one. You are a person of one. You're not anything. You're not even in a community. You know, it's a weirdly optimistic, but melancholy ending, you know, where it's like, okay, I'm just got born down this birth canal and I'm a fetus and I'm out now and I'm, what's going to happen now? Am I going to become an adjunct professor of German philosophy in a small Midwestern college? That's probably where she is.
That's where I'll be.
It's true. I've heard you say that every type of person has played Hedvig.
Yeah.
Every race, age, sexuality, and gender. I wonder if you, what performance did you find most compelling or strange or weird or even intriguing? And how the story gets taken up by others. I mean,
yeah, I love that people can do what they want with it and find their own thing and add their own jokes and add their own locale. I mean, I just came back from Asia, and Korea has taken Hedvig to its heart more than any other country.
Wow.
I think partly because it hit at a certain time of when musicals were coming in, but also, you know, that tattoo looks like the Korean flag. You know, this is a divided country still, and East and West Germany have a lot in common, or had a lot in common with North and South Korea. And I did some shows there on Christmas, and they were really fun. And It was when their president was impeached.
Oh, yeah.
And I had left some pot in my bag, and they found it. So I was kind of, I said, how dare you arrest me? You don't even have a president. It was the wrong thing to say. But I did make fun of that fascist in the show, and everybody loved it. There's actually a line in one song, which is, it's our tradition, it's in Sugar Daddy, it's our tradition to control, like Erich Honecker and Helmut Kohl, who were the East and West leaders of Germany, but we changed it from, like Erich Honecker and Yoon Suk-yeol from the Ukraine, to, and they loved it. But I still got in trouble, and I couldn't leave. Some countries, and when you bring drugs in, they throw you out. In Korea, they kept me there for a month. It was during the holidays. I wasn't in prison. I just couldn't leave, and it was cold. So I finished a play, so it was good. So, and my friend Michael Lee, who is a Korean-American actor, went there once 15 years ago to do a job, and he was like, I'm going to stay because there wasn't enough work for Asian American actors. And now he's a musical star in Korea and didn't even speak the language at first. And he did Hedwig there too. So this is a long way of saying I keep meeting people in different cultures who have played it and found something different. But the core of it is still the same. You know, I was in Thailand after that, and I sang with one of the guys who played Hedwig in Thailand. And
yeah, so great.
I love, it is drag, and drag is for everybody. You know, it's like Lena Hall, who played Yitzhak on Broadway, won a Tony, played Hedwig, you know, for a while in LA and San Francisco, and was fantastic. And, you know, we're going to do a new production, and London is probably going to be a trans actor. It's like there's a new production in Australia. I love that it happens without me, and that the sun never sets on Hedwig.
There you go.
Well, you know, Hedwig is a very moving film, and I think it's kind of exploration of, you know, self-exploration and resilience and everything. That's, you know, that resonates with lots of people.
Yeah.
But the film is—it's also the story. It's really, really funny. From the dialogue about not putting bras into the dryer, I mean, that's to give you credibility as a woman. But I love the Korean sergeant wives who are Hedwig's backup band when you're like, Kwan Lee on guitar.
She was the star of Short Bus.
That's right.
That's Suk-yeol Lee, who is popular, a well-known figure in Canada, our 51st state.
Oh, stop.
But I met her. She was a VJ on the Canadian version of MTV. And so she played this rocker
I loved her.
Girl. And so I was like, all right, you're Kwang Yi and Hedwig's band, and you're like terrible guitarist, but you love it.
So tell us more about humor in the stage version, in the film version.
I mean, my parents were funny. I mean, it's like humor is, you know, my mom's Scottish. It's, you know, and the jokes are flying off. Scottish are like the Jews of Britain. It's just nothing but jokes. Because you're slightly second-class citizens. And, you know, my mom, even when she wasn't joking, I was, you know, she'd been through the war, and I would ask to borrow the car. She's like, the car? I never saw a banana till I was 12. You can't compete with, you know, the war or the Holocaust or the genocide, you know, in the suburbs. So she was like, she'd be funny. And her mom was funny too. Like, mom brought a boy home for my granny to meet in Scotland, and he left, and mom said, what do you think? And granny said, well, I wouldn't want to look at that face over a boiled egg every morning. Tell us what you really think, granny. But, you know, if you've been through trouble, you don't have time for it, do you?
Well, one last question from me before we open up to the audience for a few questions. So Hedwig was released as a film version in 2001. It was a critical success, but not a financial success, as I understand.
Yes, it was a success d'esteem.
Celebrities showed up to watch and promote it, and you could tell us more about that. But you've speculated that 9/11 also had an impact on the film's reception. I read somewhere that you said, well, you said on September 12th in New York City, all movie theaters were free, and many people saw the film as a result over time. It also reached people, of course, in other ways, through word of mouth, of course, and DVDs. So tell us a little bit about the film's initial reception and then over time.
Well, that is a sort of sad thing now about, we're not in the era of the independent film right now. People, you guys aren't necessarily rushing to the theater to see the most interesting film of the week.
Anora?
Yes. No, it's not that they aren't winning Oscars.
Yeah.
It's just people aren't going or watching the Oscars as much. So, 12 Years a Slave, people are not rushing to, It's like, one best.
Yeah.
But they do well, and they are the best films of the year because Hollywood has sort of given up on trying to make really good films. They just given up. They make money-making films. And why shouldn't they? They're a business. They're not an art world. And it was almost a mistake when artistic films were made by Hollywood because the point of it is to make money. At a certain time, an audience might have been ready for something more perspicacious or something just deeper. And there was a time in the 70s when, Vietnam and Nixon and such had kind of the idea of the status quo was out of fashion. The 60s, it was just, that's the way it's always been done. We're over it. So Hollywood was confused and they started giving money to John Cassavetes and Robert Altman and people who were art people, but they made artistic pop hits, and there's a weird moment when Dog Day Afternoon and Network and Nashville and The Godfather are the biggest films of the year, too. It doesn't happen that way anymore, which doesn't make the form any worse. It's just economically very different right now. And in the 90s, people were rushing to the theaters. And so Hedwig was a success d'esteem is French for yeah, but can you eat it? No. Because there was no money. We were never a hit, which was fine. I don't wish huge success on anyone but my worst enemies. I really don't. Too much money, too much fame will kill you as much as poverty or destroy your soul. Luck who's in charge. But there is a sense of an opportunity now that economics have changed Hollywood and even theater, certainly in the political realm, for a new kind of DIY, a new kind of punk. In the last few years, we tried to, fix things with tactics which might have been a little pushy of like, you can't say that and that's not to be done. And you're causing offense and identity-based stuff, which would raise the profile of important issues for sure. But it also started to separate us from our natural buddies. It's like, you can't start a conversation by saying you're a straight male, therefore you really should not be talking about queer people. It's like, you're, a black woman. How dare you write about a white gay man? It's like, guys, if you're going to follow that line, you might as well cancel all fiction and just have autobiographies. Just have a Netflix of narcissists and kill your goddamn empathy. Because fiction is one of the only ways that everyone in any cultural right, left, wing, whatever you want to call it, can agree stories are important now. Because as facts become degraded, when all news is fake, all stories are true. So you got to make sure you get that right story. Because, you know, sometimes the stories veer off into crazy conspiracy theories, and it's like, how is that really helping you? Even if there is truth in it, it's like, why are you focused on all these things? And where are the good conspiracies? Why are they always negative? There's a term, there's paranoia and there's pronoia. Pronoia is the irrational belief that someone's trying to help you. That's the conspiracy that I'm looking for. There's so many people trying to help you. Do you have proof of this? Do the research on YouTube. So I feel like some of these tactics of trying to fix things and good intentions have sometimes separated us from larger goals. We know who the enemy is now. We know. And our need for purity has kind of helped him get back there. Do you know what I'm saying? A lot of people started getting really exhausted by what they were supposed to and not supposed to say. Well, we know the intentions were often very good. And it pushed them a little bit to the right. Do you know what I mean? So, but punk is an ethos, and it can be a lot of different things. But punk has the same goals of fighting racism, imperialism, fascism, conformity, capitalism. But the tactics are wildly different, right? The tactics are often offensive. You're using imagery of racism to fight racism, which is not very current. I don't want to hear that word. I feel unsafe when that word is being used in the real world. I would argue that we need punk again because the other stuff didn't work. I also come out of AIDS activism, not being a member of ACT UP, but being there when it happened. I was a little scared, but I saw this bravery and people using every tactic to do what they needed to do to survive that crisis when the government was doing nothing because they thought we deserved it. And you saw people being very punk and like in a wonderfully queer way and putting a giant condom on Jesse Helms' house, who was against safe sex. So he came out the door and it was wah. Brilliant political theater. But at the same time, some of the same group would be negotiating with the drug companies in a very practical way. You may not give a shit, but if you save all these people, you'll be rich. Mm-hmm. You know, they used every tactic. And it was violent sometimes. They'd be going down the aisle of St. Patrick's Cathedral, grabbing the Holy Communion and crushing it in front of the population. This is a person who felt that Archbishop O'Connor at the time was hated them, wanted them dead. You know what I mean? It was a lot of tactics. And not everyone's is a violent one. Not everyone's is an extreme one like that. There are other ways, right? Like there's local ways of helping and making something, again, creative with your friends in person. Let the onlineness be to get you to the in-person situation, not be the place where it happens. Because we've had enough of virtue signaling and people sort of signing on to things and doing nothing. You know what I'm saying? If I hear another land acknowledgement without actual support for a native group, virtue signaling, guys, that's not doing anything. You know what I mean? It's like do something and shut up and just do it. That's my view. And there's plenty to do. And if you can't think of something to do, volunteer, find something, you know? So it's a strange tipping point right now. It may feel hopeless. Our older tactics don't seem like they're going to work right now. But with the longer view, we've seen different things happen and we've seen a lot change. You know, and we've seen incredible shifts. Yep. I have for queer people alone, you know, that came out of the storytelling, right? More than even science, which has now been degraded again too, as right? Science is now in service of whoever's in power, when it didn't used to be that way. You know, we used to agree on some facts. So in the meantime, tell your stories, do your work in your neighborhood that's able to be done, and, you know, visit New Orleans.
I'm going to turn things over to Miguel Panabella. He's an assistant director. He's been in the job since the beginning of January, although he's been helping here at the center for years. So glad to have him back. Miguel, tell him what the rules are. We'll take about 3 questions.
My heart will be explode. not only because English is not my first language. I watched Hedwig when I was 16.
Are you Korean?
Sorry?
Are you Korean?
I am Korean. We are Korean. Yeah. 안녕하세요. I'll move into my question before I throw up. So, in your films, Hedwig's and Hedwig, Short Bus, and Rabbit Hole, the main characters all seem to start from a kind of emotional ground zero situation, having lost something fundamental, like their kid or their identity, like kind of thing. Hedwig searches for her other self, and only to realize wholeness comes from within. And the characters in Short Bus navigate loneliness in the most loneliness and repression, finding connection in the most unexpected ways. And in Rabbit Hole, grief remains ever present, but Rebecca comes to accept that it doesn't go away, it just becomes bearable. So my question is, despite their pain, these characters eventually stop clinging to their anger and move forward. So, sometimes even forgiving those who have wronged them. So, but in reality, for someone in the position of the victim, victim, the kind of transformation can be incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
So, from your perspective, I was wondering, what do you think needs to be happen first for someone to be able to move forward with forgiveness?
Well, I mean, I'm Catholic, so it's sort of built into us and confession and all that. Though you're confessing it to some creepy priest. but yes, I believe art is a healing thing. I was very religious as a kid, and then theater became my church. And in church, you can do different things. You can sing together, you can praise together, you can commemorate, you can role play, and you can forgive. And you can confess. And maybe I got so pissed off at cancel culture because there wasn't an opportunity to evolve. It wasn't always given to you. And first of all, who are we to judge? Sometimes, you know, we don't know all the facts. You know, it just felt like it was piling on. And I certainly, there were horrible people when there's a trail of victims. And then there's, I don't know, it's like, we don't know all the facts. So it's like, I don't like, it starts to become everyone's scared of each other. We're scared to talk about anything uncomfortable. So you end up having a generation who's, you know, avoids confrontation, you know, and even avoids sex because it's uncomfortable. You can't control it. And, you know, younger people are having less sex than they used to. I think that's my other assignment to you, is to get laid in a healthy fashion.
Whatever form that takes.
It did wonders for me. And what was the question? Oh, yeah, trauma. So, but all the characters are victims. They act like victims. Which, you know, they are victims of trauma, but then they take that on as their identity. And if your victimhood is your identity, you're fucked. You cannot move on. And you can even make money from it. You know, the eternal victim. And, you know, Trump somehow convinced all white people that they were victims. You know, when it was really about money, you know, and not having jobs. So it was like, if you can convince someone they're victims, Russia's convinced, you know, that they were the victim in this war. I don't know how they did that. But it's like, if you keep that going, you can justify anything. And horrible things. You've got, and which doesn't mean you weren't victimized. It's just if you identify as such, you'll never get anywhere. You know, it's you've got to figure out what's next. And forgiveness must be very hard for people who are really, really hurt by someone. And maybe it's not possible at all. But, you know, I have found that sometimes I forget, but I don't forgive. You know, some people forgive and don't forget, but I actually forget. You know, and sometimes I'm like, I think I'm supposed to be mad at that person. Can't remember why, you know. And it's great. You know, both of my parents had Alzheimer's, which I very much recommend for families in trouble, because they forget why they hated you. And my mother forgot that I was going to hell, you know, right?
Yeah.
And she, the last time the priest came and gave her the Holy Communion, she spat it across the room and it hit the wall. And she said, why are you putting paper in my mouth? And the priest scraped Christ off the wall and never came back again. I was like, it all evens out in the end, you know. So to me, it's like, get on from the victim thing. My mom was very much a victim person her whole life. And she had cause to be. She was a woman of a certain generation. She wasn't allowed to blossom. She had to be a mom. She had to follow my dad around. He loved her. He was in the closet, and she took that to be another thing. It's like, why is everyone being gay to me? You know, everything was, my dad got Alzheimer's. Why are you being Alzheimer's to me? And she was never happy because, of, and she was only happy when she got the Alzheimer's. So let that be a lesson to you. All have Alzheimer's. What? Broken social scene. I bet you have a voice we can all hear, do you?
Faculty.
Yes. No.
I too may throw up out of excitement to join the gentleman in the second row. You spoke a bit about this earlier, about Hedvig kind of needing to shed their cocoon and become naked, but costume, hair, and makeup is so... it's a character unto itself in Hedvig. So I wondered if you could speak kind of like how you use that to bring your more kind of philosophical ideas into being, kind of like how you use it. And then maybe just more like conversationally, did you have a favorite or least favorite outfit that you kind of made and performed in? You know, like what was the one that was like the most uncomfortable?
You just gave me a new drag name, Philosophical.
Sir Phyllis Diller.
There was hell of a bottom Carter.
Stop it.
It's a drag queen I know. What were we talking about? Costumes. Yes. Well, you know, I was so busy with directing and acting that I let my costume and wig and makeup person just go crazy. I was like, just put it on me. You know, I gave them a very simple brief, which is everything has to be believably affordable for this character. And it's definitely patchwork. It's definitely collage. It's juxtaposition of things that are affordable, and which was Hedvig. You know, she was a quilt person put together with bits and pieces, right? And I think I really enjoyed the hair and the Wicked Little Town song. I liked, someone made a cookie of that look for me at UCLA. What have you made me? This UC system of, who's a baking major? But it was just fun, but I was so overwhelmed. I mean, I couldn't even, that's why I had these great people around me who would sometimes make decisions without me, but I chose the right people who could do that without me. My dad was a general and in the army, and he wanted me to follow in his footsteps. And then he saw me on set, and he was like, oh, you do what I do. It's just delegate, and you make everyone feel included because they are, and you make jokes at times of tension. And then we had a drag day where even the Teamsters were in drag. Of course, it was Toronto, so they were more relaxed. The 51st state is more relaxed about things like that. Does that answer your question?
One question.
Are you Canadian? Do you have a Canadian t-shirt?
I'm not.
Oh, okay, how dare you? Cross-cultural.
Hedwig is one of my favorite movies ever, including my mom's. And the music is so special to us, and we know we quote the movie every single day. I was curious if you had a special song from the movie that really stuck out to you, lyric-wise or sound-wise?
Well, you know, I do them all the time. But I still love doing the songs, which is really rare, you know. I think probably Midnight Radio. Yeah. I just did two shows in L.A. and one on Palm Springs, and I'm probably coming back around the next year with a all Bowie show called Queen Bitch. And I also do a show called Black Star Symphony, which is the people who made Bowie's last record made it for orchestra. So we're doing that in San Francisco in June, a couple nights with, you know, two other vocalists. But yeah, it's rare that something that people liked that you were part of and made is something you still like. And I have, I'm older now, and I have a lot of friends who have become famous for things that they're not proud of. It must be really weird to be like, yo, you know, for something that you know sucks. And you're getting this approval, and so you don't quite respect them or yourself. Or, you know, that's why it's like, you know, we all have to do our money jobs, you know, and that's fine. But you've got to have your special soul thing too. It's got to be, you've got to have it. And that thing, when you put out into the world or not, you know, it could just be your beautiful garden, but the flowers go out in the world maybe, or the vegetables. That is what what you put out, of course, comes right back to you. And if you put out something half-assed, guess who wants to hang out? Really half-assed people. You put out something dishonest people are like, that's awesome. But you know it isn't. So you got to be careful what you put out, and which isn't to say it's got to be perfect, but it's got to be you, you know, and something you believe. And when you're making it with someone else, it's both of you, and that's even more fun. You know, it's hard to do it on your own, you know. I always prefer, like, I was going to write an autobiography, and then instead I made something that no one was aware of because of, it was a fictional podcast musical series called Anthem Homunculus, and the reason nobody heard it is because a company bought it and put it behind a paywall that paid us millions, and then no one heard it. I'd rather we had not had the money and that people heard it. But it is out for free now, and Glenn Close plays my mom, and Cynthia Erivo is my wife, and, you know, Patti LuPone is my aunt.
How many people can say that?
I know. We asked her to play Hedwig, you know, on Broadway. We closed before she could answer.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.